This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The brain is silent, dark, and dumb. It feels nothing. It sees nothing. The art of the brain is to transcend those daunting limitations and canvas the world. So writes Diane Ackerman in her new book, An Alchemy of Mind, The Marvel and Mystery of the Brain. Ms. Ackerman's interest in science and psychology began at an early age, but got waylaid by a technological glitch when she transferred from the college where she was studying physiological psychology to another. A computer error put her down as an English major, and she decided at the age of 18 to stick with it. She went on to write poetry and nonfiction for both children and adults. Her books include A Natural History of the Senses and A Natural History of Love. In An Alchemy of Mind, Diane Ackerman addresses a lot of questions about both the brain and the mind. What causes the tip-of-the-tongue problem we've all experienced when you know a word or a phrase but just can't retrieve it at that moment? Why are the brains of men and women different? What's boredom? What's self? What is consciousness? You can join the conversation, too. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Later in the program, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us from Boston. But first, the marvel and the mystery of the brain. Diane Ackerman joins us from the studios of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
I was very taken with that first sentence you wrote in this book. It drew us right in as a reader. Would you read that for us?
I would be delighted to. Imagine the brain, that shiny mound of being, that mouse-gray parliament of cells, that dream factory, that petty tyrant inside a ball of bone, that huddle of neurons calling all the plays, that little everywhere, that fickle pleasure drome, that wrinkled wardrobe of selves stuffed into the skull like too many clothes into a gym bag.
Mouse-gray parliament of the cells is, I think, my favorite of those.
Well, thank you. That was irresistible, of course.
One of the things you write, though, is about the evolution of the brain. And one thing that you say, our reptile brain, the very first part of our cerebral cortex, you say it gets a really bad rap.
Well, it does. But the truth is that the most primitive parts of our brain are the ones that keep us going and take care of an awful lot of the running of our bodies. You know, we like to pretend these days that we're not animal, and we even say animal as if it were a disgrace, or we say, you animal, you reptile. But the truth is that our animal nature is some of the finest and bravest and most generous parts of our nature.
And you also point out that the brain takes care of an awful lot of business without us being aware of it, and a good thing, too. We wouldn't really want to be in control of coordinating all the sinuous developments of our intestines every minute of the day.
It would be impossible. I couldn't do the Krebs cycle. The brain links the outer and the inner environments and also the world to the internal milieu of the body. So when we talk about having a self, it's not really an awareness of the world. It's really more of a response or more of an opinion about the world. And, of course, we filter out an awful lot of all of the different sensations and stimuli that are taking place. And then on top of that, much of what happens stays unconscious anyway.
And you also point out, I mean, by the time most of us get to work every day, we've utterly paid no attention to deeds as complex as driving a car through traffic.
Thank heavens. We do things so many times that they become habitual, which really just means that we're able to slur over the details. Because if you think about it, living in the moment is wonderful, but you really couldn't live in every fraction of every moment all the time. You'd be at red alert all the time. So the brain needs to coast a little bit. And I think one of the things we find most charming about artists is that they're able to force their brains to stop doing that and look at the individual slices of life, all of the different processes and textures that we need to slur over in order to master the world around us.
yet that brain is also exquisitely tuned to be alert when it needs to be.
Yes, paying attention is one of evolution's best tricks. After a talk that I gave one evening, a nature talk, in which I was praising slugs, because I do think they're cute and adorable, a man came up and...
A little peculiar in this respect, but
well,
go ahead.
Yes, but you know, they mate at the end of slime gallows, and they stand up in the grass like little giraffes and look... But enough on slugs.
Okay.
A man came up and told me that he was trapped under a piece of heavy machinery at one point in his work, and he was waiting in a panic to be rescued, and he looked over to his right, and there was a slug sitting up and just paying attention to him. All animals learn to pay attention, and then there is a question of what passes the threshold of being really important to get your attention. And, of course, in the culture that we now live in, which is so thick with sensory overload, takes more and more to get our attention.
Yet you tell a very funny story about penguins on the Falkland Islands after the British Royal Air Force put jets there, a totally novel item for these penguins, and who went to alert every time they saw one take off.
Yes, the penguins all looked up at the planes, and the pilots decided that they would play a trick on the penguins. You know, it's a little bit dull down there. And they had nothing better to do, and they zoomed out to sea, and then they flew directly over the head of the penguins. All of the penguins looked up, and they all toppled over in unison, like dominoes.
But they never caught on, I guess, or it took them a while to catch on to the idea that this was no longer novel. That this was something that, after the third time you see it, it's just another F4.
I think it takes about three times. You know, once can be an instance. Two, well, maybe it's a coincidence. By three, you already have a pattern. It's a genre now, and after that, you can kind of expect it.
The brain, again, another thing it does extraordinarily well, as you describe in your book, is seize on patterns like that, first to see whether they're threatening or not, but also to look for patterns in almost anything as a kind of it saves space. It's a time-saving device.
Oh, yes. That's one of the key things that the brain does. It simplifies, it organizes, and it has to. It has to reduce just a deluge of sensory information to some sort of manageable sum. And from that, the brain produces a cozy effigy of the world whose features it can then monitor, and anything that doesn't fit or signals trouble can draw a response. So you see someone across the street and you register. You know how this goes. It takes a few steps before you actually find that you can say, hey, it's Mom.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Diane Ackerman about her new book, An Alchemy of Mind, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Mark, who's with us in Fort Myers, Florida.
Hi, Neil. Diane, I don't know if you can hear me. I'm in a bad spot. I've been listening for a while. I'm just going through a bad spot now. I wanted to ask Diane if she could reflect on something where at times of high stress, for the last 20 years, I'm 42, for whatever reason, my brain has been able to anticipate things that I shouldn't be able to anticipate.
First of all, I want to praise you for being able to pay attention while you're out there.
Yeah.
But the brain is able to pay attention especially well when you're under high stress, and it may seem to you, because of course everything could be important in staying alive, and it may seem to you that you're anticipating things.
Well, the examples I would give you is something like I'd turn on the radio, know the song before I turn on the radio, or get a phone call from a friend out of the blue that I haven't heard from for years and no reason to expect a call from. Most recently, at my son's urging, I played the lottery. I'm not a gambler. I don't play the lottery, but I picked these numbers and I thought they'd be right, and they weren't right, but I did get three. And then my son noticed that if you looked at the other lottery number of the day, the pick four or something, the other three numbers are there. So I don't know if it's coincidence, but it could be coincidence. But I've noticed for about 20 years it's been like that since taking final exams in college.
Well, in the case of the lottery numbers, I think probably it is coincidence. But the other things you're talking about, I think, are due to a really fascinating sleight of mind that happens. There's a time lag of half a second.
There's a time lag of half a second, and apparently a longer time lag with our connection to the studio in Ithaca, New York at Cornell University, where Diane Ackerman is with us right now, but apparently we've lost the connection momentarily. Are you there, Diane?
Yes.
Ah, you're back.
I am here.
Okay, good. Why don't you go on?
Well, as I was saying, there's a time lag of about half a second between perceiving something and being conscious of it. It just takes time for a perception to reach the brain and then for the brain to circulate the news and for everything finally to hit your awareness. So it feels like we sense things and know about them in the same instant, but we don't. Brain time isn't world time, and it can feel like you're anticipating something, but it can just have to do with how the brain functions. We're a little bit offbeat by design.
And in fact, you raise an even more, Mark, by the way, thanks very much for the phone call and drive carefully.
Yes.
But you raise an even more interesting point about that time lag, which is a question about something we all feel very strongly about, free will.
Oh, yes. If there is this time lag, then are we really acting in a free way? Because after all, if your body knows, your brain knows to do something before you're aware of it, where does the instinct to do it come from?
Who makes the decision? Yeah.
Who makes the decision? Especially since there does seem to be a watchman in the pantry who's backdating events.
A watchman in the pantry, another of the interesting metaphors that are scattered throughout this book. Let's get another caller on the line. David is with us from Detroit.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question relates to what you were talking about earlier with patterns. I understand from a psychological standpoint, patterns, emotional patterns, are set down in youth, both psychologically and biologically. And I'm wondering if those can be changed as an adult after your brain has already developed and set those patterns in place.
Absolutely. That's because patterns require memory, which happens all over the brain. We really are a sum of our memories, and it's the brain's main business. But memories are true to the moment of recall. And every time you remember something or you remember to do something, you can alter it just a tiny bit and formulate it in a new way. Yes, habits are very hard to change, especially bad habits, but they can be if you continue.
And we're continuing to have difficulties with our connection to Ithaca, New York. Our Diane Ackerman is with us there in the studios, and we're having a couple of interruptions between now and again. Tell you what, I think we're going to... there she is again.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I can only assume it's sunspots.
Well, maybe it's that time of the year. It could be sunspots.
Okay.
Anyway, we were talking about the interruptions with David in Detroit, but you know what? We're coming up on a break. So, David, we're going to have Answer interrupt us. Thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're going to continue our conversation with Diane Ackerman, who's the author of many books, most recently, An Alchemy of Mind, The Marvel and Mystery of the Brain. If you'd like to get in our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, and that's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. If the sunspots will allow us, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're continuing our conversation with poet and natural history writer Diane Ackerman. Her latest book is An Alchemy of Mind, The Marvel and Mystery of the Brain. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Diane Ackerman, I wanted to ask you to expound for a little bit on just something I had never thought of in this way before. You're writing about the evolution of the brain and what is essentially a problem of space.
Yes, we have wrinkled brains because we wanted to store so much in our minds that there just wasn't enough room, and yet the head had to be small enough to come out of the birth canal. Really, the only solution was a packing solution, which was to cram things in as if it were fabric that was being folded up. And that's why the brain looks as folded as it does. It literally has been stuffed into that trunk.
And to acquire something as complicated and space-consuming as language, you report on speculation that really what we have done is jettison some other skills that we might have had in the past.
Language was so important that we were willing to give up an enormous amount of space in the brain for it. And without language, it would be very hard to have a conversation with even oneself, mm-hmm. let alone communicate with someone else or one's children. But we could at one time have had all sorts of other fascinating abilities. When you just think about the possibilities that other animals have, maybe we had other sorts of sensory devices. And maybe even some people who as adults are psychic or have other kinds of gifts just haven't lost some of those abilities.
And that with language, though, the brain, you said, has done something unparalleled in the history of life on Earth and began storing information and memories outside itself.
Isn't that extraordinary? We're the only creatures on Earth who do that. And because we have brains, we can extend ourselves through time and space and do lots of things that we didn't evolve to be able to do. We've really started creating or recreating our own evolution in that way. Another thing about language that I think is amazing is that all language is poetry. That's the way the brain works. It needs a continuous array of metaphors. But we're just not used to it. We don't think about it very often. But for example, one of my favorites, I think, is a flight of stairs. Or because we happen to inhabit a visceral body, we need some way of embodying thought. And so we talk about things outside of ourselves as if they were us. And
anthropomorphism.
Exactly. We do that all the time. Or we think of things as containers. You know, love is something that you can fall into. All over the world, there is a hidden poetry in every language that people use. It's just that we don't pay attention to it very often, or we wouldn't be able to conduct conversations.
Well, what a leap of imagination. Let's get another conversation in with a listener. Tom joins us on the phone from Minneapolis.
Hi, appropriate that you should come to me after just discussing language there. I'm actually calling regarding music, and I wonder if you have any observations about, I guess, how music maybe affects the brain and vice versa, how the brain affects music.
Well, first of all, I think music evolved long before language as something that humans used as a form of pure emotional communication. And in tests that have been done with people all over the world, they find that everyone responds to the same sorts of music with certain kinds of emotions. And I think that it's just something much more urgent and original than language, and we needed it. I'm sure that it was paying attention to the sounds of nature, both the sounds that suggested danger as well as the sounds that were just those of birds and other animals. Well, for example, think about the sound of chalk on a blackboard and how that just makes you twitch and shiver. And that's very similar to the sound of, let's say, a cat, a large cat's claws on rock. We now do a lot of things with sound and create an artificial form of sound that we call our own different kinds of music, but I'm sure it evolved to make us survive better in our environment.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you.
We tended to think of music as something unique to the human species, yet you write about a species of frog that, to all intents and purposes, makes music.
Oh, yes. Actually, there are many that do, that seem to play musical instruments, that choose how much water, in the case of the frog, to sit in so that when it's croaking, it will be playing at different notes, or who choose different sized logs or trees that have holes in them so that they essentially become pipes. And don't forget that there are whales that have wonderful long songs, and they use rhyme to remember their longest songs, just the same way that we do.
Why is it, asks Eric Haluzak of Portland, Oregon, why is it that I can remember Avogadro's number, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd, something that I learned 10 years ago and never use, but I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday?
Well, long-term memory and short-term memory are, just as they sound, very different critters. It takes a long time for short-term memories to get digested and really solidified in memory. And sleep seems to play an important role in it. So when students ask my advice about studying for exams, I always tell them not to do all-nighters. It seems to be really important to get some sleep to consolidate those memories in the short term.
Keith Fisher asks, is there anything to the feeling that you're being watched when you are?
You mean people who are paranoid really do have some people who are out to get them?
I think that's along those lines, yeah.
Yes. You know, it's a joke, but also I was saying a moment ago that I think we've evolved a sensory efflorescence that we're not aware of. We have many more than five senses, I'm sure. And I don't know how close this person would be who would be watching you, but everybody goes through this.
Let's get another caller in on the line. This is John, who's calling from Landstuhl in Germany.
Hello, Diane.
Hi,
Dan. Just wanted to ask you, I developed a theory back when I was in college about the nature of humor. And then a person tells a joke, and what you do is you establish a pattern within the person's brain. And then finally, when you drill the punchline in, what it's doing is it's giving somebody something that's more logical than the pattern that they had already developed. So it causes the brain to sort of malfunction and gives a short circuit, which causes us to laugh. Do you have a theory behind exactly what causes humor?
I think they're all forms of humor, and I'm sure there are different purposes for how we use humor now, but I think maybe in the beginning, people laughed together, played and laughed together, in part to bond with each other and show that they were not being in any way aggressive. You know, if you think about laughing, it looks kind of aggressive. You're showing your teeth, your mouth is open. It's close to a kind of growl, but it's not really. And it could easily be a social way of bonding.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, John.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Mike. Mike's calling from Tallahassee, Florida.
Neil and Diane, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Good afternoon.
Diane, I'm wondering if you've given any thought to the notion that speakers of different languages live in different thought worlds. For example, we see German, a highly technical language, and sure enough, they build some great cars.
I do think that people who speak different languages and people in different cultures do indeed live in a different thought world. This is not so fashionable a theory right now. It was made popular many years ago by Benjamin Lee Whorf, who wrote a wonderful book called Language and Language, Thought, and Reality, in which he went all around the world studying cultures for exactly that reason. And he found that there were some cultures in which they just didn't have a concept of beginning, middle, and end in the same way that we do, or didn't have container concept. They wouldn't say that that was a carton of milk. Instead, they thought more of an intensity or an emphasis. I think this is true of countries, cultures, and even maybe to some extent the private small cultures of couples and families.
Well, I'm thinking also of Plains Indians with a language that in many respects did not express tenses, past, present, future. Everything was pretty much present tense.
Yes, he did a lot of study with the Hopi Indians and others. And yes, everything is in a kind of free-flowing, ongoing present. So would it make life easier for, let's say, a physicist who came out of there? I don't know. It might.
Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Donatus, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who joins us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, that's correct.
Go ahead.
My question was to do with fighter pilots, NASCAR, you know, high-speed race drivers. Is it something about their brain chemistry that allows them to process, you know, multitudes of information and be able to excel at what they do? And what does that mean for the rest of us? I mean, are we predisposed towards, you know, being a fighter pilot one day, for example, even if I've not had that trend in my family, for example? How can you speak to that?
Yes, this is the era of multitasking, but and fighter pilots have to do that kind of thing, but we do it in an everyday way too. It's not as effective or faster than doing things one at a time, because MRI studies of multitasking, which is really just the polite word for attention binging, reveal that paying attention to two things at once doesn't double the brain's activity. It actually lowers it. It shortchanges both. The brain does one thing at a time instead of doing them simultaneously. This is a real issue for us, I think, because we're living in a time of great sensory overload and a kind of rapid-paced, novelty-mad society that may indeed be making permanent changes in the brain of our children and ourselves. It's brand new in human evolution.
Yet one thing that sort of underlies Donatus's question is this quality of mind that some people refer to as situational awareness, and that's what they would say fighter pilots and race car drivers are really good at.
By situational awareness, of course, you mean that they are just attuned to all of the different fantasia of sensation and stimuli in that place where they are, mm-hmm. and they've left the rest of the world, so they are masters of paying attention. That's true, but don't forget they also may well be thrill seekers at some level, and that means that there's going to be a kind of natural amphetamine going through their bodies, which would also cause them to be focused more tightly, paying better attention.
Donatus, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Diane Ackerman about her new book, An Alchemy of Mind. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call in from Chris, who's on the road with us from Georgia.
Hi, Dan.
It's Neil, but go ahead.
Oh, hi, Dan. First of all, I want to say everything sounds very interesting, what you guys are talking about so far. I kind of wrote a thesis somewhat similar to that, talking about the mind and the way it I guess, works with the body. And I did a lot of study on Sartre, and after a while I really started to realize that the kind of mind and body, the way you talk about it in a duality, it's almost one thing. Your mind is your body, and your body is your mind, the way that they work together. I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
The brain does an awful lot of things besides run the mind. I think of the mind as a comforting mirage sponsored by the brain so that we feel intact and continuous from moment to moment. But, of course, the brain is running many other programs. And the sense of self that we feel is really an illusion of self. It's many selves. We all have a secret society of selves. And so much so that it's amazing we wake up each day and there we are, and we know who we are. You might find this true if you think about the different people that you know and how you might emphasize oneself with different friends. and why you perhaps discovered that even though it might have been fun to get all of your friends together, well, maybe they wouldn't really get on with each other.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was one thing I was worried about, like almost a multiple identity type thing.
Everyone has a multiple identity.
But try to keep one of them in charge while you're driving, Chris.
Oh, yes.
Thanks very much. I wanted you to tell us a story, Diane Ackerman. You have a molecule named after you. How did this happen?
Oh, I do. And it happens to be a sex pheromone in crocodilians, which I find flattering. I spend part of my life as a naturalist.
Oh, you reptile, you.
Oh, yes. Low down. As a naturalist, I spend some time studying crocodilians, which is alligators and crocodiles and their kin. And in terms of their brains, their brain is kind of a dial tone, you know. But I wanted to find out what life was like for them. And so I signed on a team of people who were sexing alligators. And what you have to do first is lasso your alligator, pull it onto the bank, climb on top of it, hold its eyes down. Alligators have pop-up eyes. Reach under the tail. And you reach inside, you do an internal, and then you know if it's a male or a female alligator. And because I guess the chemists involved thought that it was rather sporting of me to be willing to do this, they named a molecule Diane Ackerone.
That's very nice.
I love it.
I'm pleased the alligators all let you live after this examination.
Yes. Well, they were maybe a little disoriented.
But they got along with the rest of their lives, I presume, after they got back in the water.
Not only did they, they don't have great short-term memory anyway. And they were busy as could be in their courting habits. And alligators, when they're courting, look like they're mating Swiss Army knives. So it was really quite extraordinary to be out there working with them.
We just have about... I did want to raise this question before we left. We don't have very much time left, but I did want to ask you a question. Again, we try to define ourselves as human, you know, opposable thumbs, user of tools. All of that has been, we found other animals do all those things. You address the issue of consciousness. Is that a uniquely human trait?
Other animals probably do have some basic form of consciousness, but if we're talking about an awareness of self in the world, it's a very limited part of our mind, the type we're talking about, and we've managed to define it in a way that would exclude other animals. But we should remind ourselves that thinking about something, being consciously aware of it, is just one sort of brain work. We've adapted to our environment. Other animals have adapted well to theirs.
So we think about thinking and worry about thinking.
Yeah, and we think about the fact that we can think about other people thinking about our thinking.
I think we'll leave it there. Diane Ackerman, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Diane Ackerman's new book is An Alchemy of Mind, The Marvel and Mystery of the Brain. She joined us from the studios at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. When we come back, Ken Rudin from the Democratic Convention in Boston. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.